Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this slightly adapted panel. As you can see, there's only two of us on the stage. I'm afraid Bill James is unable to attend. His wife was taken into hospital very urgently yesterday, so obviously we wish her and him the best. We will do our best to cover Bill to some extent. John has very graciously agreed to read a short story, actually some extracts from one of Bill's novels. And I will introduce Bill as if he was here. So that's kind of weird, isn't it? But anyway. Whoops, that was weird too.
Is that a
Miles, hard, what are you doing? Yeah, I think it was. I'll keep going. Okay. I'm a trooper.
Brave man.
My name's Paul Johnston. I have written 10 crime novels, but that pales into complete insignificance. I thought that John here had written 70 novels. That is what it says on one of the pages of his website, I think, or somewhere I found. He told me just now that he's actually written 100 this book, Far Cry, that's out now, is his 100th published book. Well done, John. Let me just tell you what we're going to do over the next hour or so. We will talk and read and generally fight amongst ourselves over the next 45 minutes. Then you have 15 minutes to address fiendish questions to us. And at the end of that, we will depart, and John will be happy to sign books in the signing room exactly next door. I'll remind you of that at the end. So, let me introduce first the author who's here. John Harvey is one of the UK's best and best-selling and most respected crime writers. He's the winner of the Cartier Diamond Dagger for distinguished service to crime writing, as well as numerous other awards, including two in France. According to his publishers, he's the final word in crime writing, so I guess the rest of us just give up, do we, John? He's best known for his Charlie Resnick series, which are 10 plus Cold in Hand, is that right?
Yeah.
11, yeah. That's the last one so far. Also three Frank Elder novels, and also short stories and poetry as well. And his latest book, Far Cry, which is a non-Resnick novel, is out right now. I don't know, what was the actual publication date, John?
Sometime last week
it was out. That's about, among other things, the always tricky subject of missing or abducted children. He was born in London, lived a long time in Resnick's stomping ground of Nottingham, has also lived in Cornwall, and he's now back in London. And as many of you no doubt know, he has a long-standing interest in jazz. The missing person, we should really have an empty chair, a la Dickens, Bill James, grew up in Cardiff and studied at the University College there. He was subsequently a journalist in London, including work for the Daily Mirror. He wrote his PhD thesis, he's, you know, a crime writer on a different level to most of us, on Anthony Pohl's Dance to the Music of Time, what would one call it, compendium of novels. He's best known for his Harper and Isles series, which I think is at 25, although the print in his books are so small that I couldn't actually quite be sure that I'd counted correctly. The latest is called In the Absence of Isles. There's been a TV version. Of course, there's been a TV version of John's novels, John's Resnick novels. Bill's also popular in France and has won the prestigious award Prix du Polar Européen, something like that. He also writes spy fiction. There are 7 non-Harper and Isles novels under his name, Bill James. He also writes under the pseudonym David Craig, and also under his real name, James Tucker. I wasn't sure whether I was allowed to mention that, but I have now, so now you know his real name. And Marcel Berlins of the Times has said that for many years, James has been writing some of the most potent crime fiction in Britain. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome John Harvey and the missing Bill James.
Thanks. It's very kind of odd looking around the room and realising I know at least half the people. Here, you know, Jesus, if your friends didn't come and support you, we'd be in a telephone box. I want to read a little bit of Bill James' Roses, because it's my favourite of his books. I think it's one of the best crime novels written, really. You know, certainly since the heady days of Chandra and Hammett, etc., etc. I like it because it's got all of Bill's usual virtues. It's very funny, in a kind of somewhat quirky and surprising way. The characters, especially the characters of Harper and Isles and Harper and his wife and Harper and his daughters, I think are written beautifully because they both manage to be convincing but yet behave and say things that you know people would never actually say in real life. And how he quite manages to do that, of having these people talk and behave in kind of non-realistic ways and yet write what's basically a believable book with believable characters, I'm not quite sure, and he's not saying, at least he's not saying today. I'm really sad he's not here. I've never done an event with him in England. We've done several events together in France because we're lucky enough to have the same publisher in France. So hopefully that will happen on another occasion. What I like about Roses, Roses is that apart from having all those other things I've mentioned, it's a perfectly formed book. It's very short. It's just over 200 pages. The form of the book, I think, is brilliant. It begins at the end. I'll read the first sentence in a minute. It's one of the best first sentences I've ever come across. And then it goes on, and the end is the moment before the beginning. And then within the book, it goes back in time so that you see why what's happening is happening. And simultaneously, you have the investigation, the forward-going investigation into the death that you hear about in the first sentence. And you know, times being what they are, I have recourse to my glasses at this point. That's better. As you said, it's small print. That's my excuse. This is the first sentence of Roses, Roses. When she was killed by three chest knife blows in a station car park, Megan Harper had been on her way home to tell her husband she was leaving him for another man. I think that's fantastic. And it's brave. I mean, how great to start off the book killing off, you know, one of the main characters in the series, the wife of one of the two main detectives, and just having it right out there at the start instead of kind of, you know, building up to it. And three chest knife blows. You wouldn't normally say that, would you? You'd normally phrase that slightly differently. But he's a canny old bugger, Bill, you see. He does that, I'm sure, because he wants that sentence to strike home, but also he wants us to hesitate over it slightly. He doesn't want it to be too smooth. He wants us to note that it's there. So it's about Megan, who's been having an affair in London, off and on for a while. She's coming home to finally tell Colin Harper that their marriage is over and she's leaving him. And throughout the book, you have the train journey that she's on that ends with her being killed at the end of the journey. So I'll just read a couple of little bits from the train journey and then the very end. On the way back in the train, Megan had rehearsed what she would say to Colin. You've seen it coming. You won't care. It's just a matter of who made the break first. Seated there in the almost empty train, formulating, she could gaze along the length of the brightly lit carriage, then the next, and even part of the next. The view had helped Megan think of her life stretching far ahead, bright too, a bit like the unending corridors in that surreal video, L'année dernière at Marienbad, which she loved and which Colin naturally denounced as pretentious bullshit. A man sat in the next but one carriage, almost at the limit of her vision, apparently gazing towards her as she gazed towards him. It was too far to make out much. There was communication. There was no communication. Capsuled people. Perhaps he wondered who she was travelling alone, as she wondered who he was travelling alone. Possibly with a fur collar to his overcoat. Probably he was not looking at her at all. He might even be asleep, despite his upright posture. The distance was too great to see his eyes. It was one of those situations, though, where you hoped a man, maybe a youngish man, felt interested in you, appreciated your appearance even from afar, and spotted depths. Although she also hoped he didn't. It might have troubled Megan had he stood up and made his way towards her. Once or twice, Colin had asked her about the wisdom of coming in late by train so often, so regularly. It was his training to see the world as menace, and believe there were people charting your movements. He never pushed it. Couldn't, because that would be using his safety points to keep her tied home. He would despise that. The man she was looking at stayed where he was, and perhaps she smiled minutely at the tortuous, contrary ways by which she'd reached this point in her life. Up the train, The man seemed to return her smile. That scared her for a moment, but then gratified her. But she did not want her smile misunderstood and turned away, pretending to check some items in her carrier bags. When she glanced back, he was unquestionably watching, definitely not asleep, eyes visible and interested. The end of the journey, she gets back late at night to the car park, which is otherwise more or less deserted. She feels perfectly okay until she goes a certain distance across the car park, and then she has a sudden jolt of fear when she's almost at the car. Five paces. It would be five more. Megan had worked this out in advance. After all, five paces was only five paces, and for most of the little time it took, she kept her gaze on where she was going, that car door. But she did have a chance too for a direct, hard, even brave gaze at and among the disgusting trees around the car park. And there was definitely nobody about. Nobody cashing in on all that treacherous cover. Vague and buried horror memories from Hansel and Gretel and Babes in the Wood just had to explain her untidy panic. Plus maybe some sloppy moral feelings of guilt. She must have been unconsciously, stupidly expecting punishment. Thought nature in tree form must turn against her. How weak and deeply farcical that was. And of course, the thing about most of those fairy tale woods was that they did turn out benign in the end, offering children the very comfort denied them by humans. Nature was a safe, warm bed, not a bloody ambush. Bent over the lock in the car park, Megan heard footsteps. Undistinguished, undisguised, and swift. She did not look around, but hurried to get the car door open. Crazily, a line from Endgame on that earlier trip to town rushed to her mind. This is what we call making an exit. A hand grabbed her shoulder and pulled her up straight and around, and she saw the fur collar, the moustache, the knife. "Christ!" she screamed. I thought you fancied me. But there's work to do, he replied. I think that's just great. I love it. I wish I could write that.
Well, as you say, John, it's a shame that Bill couldn't be here, but you did a good job impersonating him. Let's move on to you. Well, as I said at the beginning, you've written 100, you've had 100 novels published. When was your first one published? Do you remember?
75.
75, so.
Avenging Angel by Tom Ryder. Tom with an H and Ryder with a Y. A masterpiece of Hell's Angels bacchanalia.
Well, that's the Hell's Angels, but there are also various other genres that you dabbled in, such as?
Well, there's about 40 or between 40 and 50 westerns under probably five or six names.
Would you like to give us some of the names, please?
For quite a while, I was half of John J. McLaglen. I don't know, Mike Stotter is in the audience, probably can remember these names better than I can. I can't remember. I can't remember the other. What happened in those days was when we were, myself and a few other people were writing a lot of westerns, paperback westerns. In Britain, in the late 70s, just into the early 80s, for some reason, there was a huge demand for paperback westerns written by British writers for the British market, although some of them were sold in America. And what we did was to kind of work in pairs and have a joint pseudonym so that we would think of a series, say, Herne the Hunter, which was the John J. McLaglen series, which Lawrence James and I wrote, and then we would work on the character together and think of a couple of storylines, and then we would write alternate books under the same name. And normally Lawrence did the odd numbers and I did the even numbers. Generally. Later on it got a bit confusing, because like if he was on holiday I had to do two odd numbers. And so it did get so that I don't actually know necessarily which ones I wrote and which, and the only way I can tell is looking at the end of the book. And if it's got a thorough, if it's got an ending a bit like that, if it's got a very kind of down ending, then I wrote it. If the hero goes out in a blaze of glory, then it was one of Lawrence's or Angus's.
Do you think the readers had any idea that there was more than one writer involved?
No. I don't think they even thought there was a writer involved. I don't think.
What a deus ex machina.
Well, I don't want to be disparaging, and there may well be Western writers apart from Mike Stotter in the room. Readers, I mean, and writers, I beg your pardon, Mike. I don't think it occurred to people who were, you know, buying Hawk 3 or, you know, Lawmen 5 that there was an actual writer. I mean, they knew there was a name on the cover, but, you know, it said Lawmen 5 in big letters. I mean, if there was an author's name there, it was in...
Yeah.
It didn't matter, really. It didn't matter to anybody. It didn't matter to the publisher. You know, as long as they got 50,000 words of clean manuscript that they didn't have to edit on the date that you promised it,
yeah,
and they could pass it on to the printer, that was...
And how many of these per year?
12 or 13 a year. One a month, basically.
That's, yeah. I mean, that's the equivalent of, I mean, obviously 50,000 words is fairly short, but I mean, it's the equivalent of 6 full-length novels a year.
Yeah. Well, you didn't get very much for any one of them, you see. So
there's still a lot to write, though.
You had to. Well, I suppose so, but, you know, think about it. If you sit down at 9 o'clock in the morning at an electric typewriter, as it was in those days, and you start writing, and with, you know, a couple of breaks, you finish at 4:30 in the afternoon, you've done a lot of work. It's not as though you're going to have to think of the plot. You know, there are only 4 or 5 plots. I mean, so, you know, what you had to let your imagination work on, I think, was ways of, you know, making those plots appear slightly different, having kind of slightly strange or amusing things happen with the characters, and, you know, just kind of shaking it up a bit. But basically, you know, you just wrote it because it was there, you know?
Were there any, you know, kind of restrictions or guidelines on what you could do?
The only ones told very clearly was that you had to have a lot of dialogue, because people who bought those books were put off by lots of text on the page. You had to have a lot of white space. I mean, the first couple of things I wrote, they didn't have a lot of dialogue, because my dialogue was not the best part of my writing, shall we say, at the time. And I tended to avoid it. And then the first couple of books came back and said, this is fine, but, you know, we've got to have lots of white space on the page. And the other great thing about that was, if you did as I did in those days, you had a page count until you could stop. Say you were working on 20 pages a day or 25 pages a day. You get towards the end of a chapter, you could have one of those kind of bits of where it's like, no, yes, no, yes, yes, no. And then you were down the bottom of the page. There was lots of white space there. And you turned over onto page 20 and you could go, you know, you could pack it in for the day.
Pub, yeah.
It was fantastic.
You also wrote some war stories, some mercenary stories.
I did 6 books about the mercenaries, yes. And three books called Death Shop, which was about this secret organisation whose job it was to invent devious and deadly tricks in order to defeat the Hun, as I'm sure we probably called them in those days.
I remember Bosch.
The Bosch, yes. The first book begins with these chaps in tweeds standing around a beautiful field in this idyllic English scene, watching this golden retriever sort of, you know, happily playing and jumping across the grass, and then in about 2 paragraphs time the retriever blows up into a mass of blood and gristle, and they're saying, oh, that works jolly well, old chap, that'll that was the kind of thing, I'm afraid, you know, gods. No wonder they only took a month. You're surprised, having heard that they took as long as a month.
And how about crime novels of that sort?
I did 4 very bad crime novels about a private eye called Scott Mitchell, which I wrote for Sphere Books, and I made a serious mistake there, which is to put them under my name, because at the time I thought they were really good. You know, I mean, I didn't even have youth on my side. You know, I can't even, you know, I was old enough to know better. I thought this was the answer. So, you know, how do you write a Raymond Chandler type private eye novel successfully with an English setting? God, I mean, you know, deluded, and they were terrible, frankly. They were terrible. But they were published with, you know, very kind of garish covers, and came out. And when I was over in Baltimore at BoucherCon last year. Someone had a set of four in the dealer's room, and I think they'd be going for something like $300, $400 or something. So, you know, they've got some monetary worth and some rarity value, but believe me, no literary value whatsoever. And that was why I didn't write any more crime novels for years after that, because I thought, I can't do this. I thought this wasn't my thing. I didn't think I could do it.
So instead of then moving into crime writing, as you say, you moved into TV.
I moved into TV because the Western market died up basically after you know, about 5 or 6 years. I think whoever was buying Westerns was getting videos from the corner shop instead. I think that was kind of maybe what took over, and I think, you know, that kind of real buzz of buying Western books, which was enormous when it lasted. I mean, we were all chasing after a series called Edge, which was written by a man called Terry Harknett. I think New English Library probably published between 4 and 6 Edge books a year. They would sell around 100,000 copies each in paperback. I mean, that's phenomenal.
What was the time scale of this? What decade was it?
This you make it sound so. This was late 70s, mid to late 70s. And because Edge sold so incredibly well, that was why all the other publishing houses wanted to get people to write Westerns. You know, Patrick Jansen Smith, still out there starting new publishing lists left, right and centre, rang me at home one day. I'd written about 2 Hell's Angels books and something else, can't remember what, and said, we're looking for someone to write a Western series, are you interested? I mean, you know, can you imagine someone doing that today? Ringing you on the telephone saying, we're looking for someone to write a crime series. Would you, you know, have the time to do one for us?
We should be so lucky.
Exactly, I know.
So tell us about the TV script writing experience.
I really enjoyed it, actually. I did 2 classic series, I suppose they're called, for the BBC, adaptations of Arnold Bennett novels, Anna of the Five Towns and The Old Wives' Tale. You know, lots of kind of coaches and people in top hats and long dresses and things. And that was great. I really enjoyed that. And then I did a bit of kind of tarting around and did a couple of episodes of Spender and kind of anything else that was going, some Ruth Rendell's. The very worst of the adaptations of Ruth Rendell, like, get shown every now and again, because I get a small sum of money for it. I think it's called The Secret House of Death. I think that was the one that I did, or maybe it wasn't. Anyway, the one with my name on, avoid it, it's dreadful. And so I did that for a while, and then I wrote a series for Central Television called Hard Cases, which ran for 2 seasons. It was about the probation service, but set in Nottingham and filmed mostly on location in Nottingham. And it was kind of like Hill Street Blues, but instead of the police, it was the probation service. I mean, that was my idea, to try and, you know, rewrite Hill Street Blues, but in Nottingham, and without the police. You know, I mean, foolish, really.
Except that you did work out a fairly interesting technique, didn't you?
Well, what I did was I'd always been fascinated. I mean, I loved Hill Street Blues. I mean, as Paul was saying, it seems to be one of those shows now, when you look at it, it looks incredibly dated. It seems to have dated very fast. But I was always interested in how much story they got done in 50 minutes or 48 minutes or whatever. How many characters they used and how they were able to do that. That kind of multi-strand narrative. So I just looked at several episodes with a stopwatch. And I made a note of how long there was in each scene, and which how many characters appeared. And then I planned that out on a, I don't think I had a whiteboard in those days, it was probably a big piece of white paper. I planned that out, all those kind of little segments, exactly timed. And then the first episode of Hard Cases, I wrote to that plan, except instead of having 6 police officers with Frank Furillo at the center, I had my probation officers with a chief probation officer at the center. And I did it kind of scene by scene. In exactly that way, just as an exercise, really, to see if I could do it, see how it worked, and then Central Television. It was one of those quirky things, right? I'd already been doing this, and Ted Childs, who was head of Central Television Drama at the time, wrote a kind of open letter or whatever, or an article in The Guardian, saying, bemoaning the fact that there were no British television writers who wrote scripts like Hill Street Blues. So. I wrote back and said, got in touch with him and said, well, funnily enough, I have a script which is like Hill Street Blues a bit, and they commissioned that, and they did two series of that, and from doing that I went on to do the first Resident, which I saw as being more of a multi-strand narrative than it became. I didn't see it. Resnick was going to be like Frank Farrillo in Hill Street Blues. He was going to be like the middle management person at the centre with the other characters and the other stories spinning off around him. I didn't think he was going to be quite as prominent as he became.
There's a kind of interesting cycle of feedback or feed forward or whatever else there, isn't there? I mean, normally, the idea of writing a book on the basis of a TV programme is kind of unusual, I guess.
I suppose so. I mean, I think apart from wanting to do the kind of multi-narrative thing, I was just excited about writing something about Nottingham, you know, and having filmed, you know, done the filming there for two seasons and so on. It seemed to me a good place to set a crime novel. So I'd been living there for quite a while then.
I was going to ask you whether the probation service material that you'd used in the TV series also kind of brought you back into the crime area.
Yeah, no, it did. It did, absolutely. And I have a good friend, still a good friend, who, I mean, still advises me on some of the stuff I do now, who helped me with the probation service stuff. I mean, he worked at the time in Nottingham. And it did get me back to working in crime and so on. But see, the thing I was always frightened of about writing either a crime novel or a book that was longer than 128 pages, which is what all the pulp stuff was running out of ideas and running out of steam and it becoming tedious. And that's why the idea of a multi-narrative appealed to me, because I thought, you know, you can always skip around then. When this bit risks getting boring, you can go to that bit and so on. And you can have four or five stories going all the time as well. You don't have to have just one story. So once I thought, well, I could do that and I could have a lot of material, and it might end up, you know, big enough to be a book that might actually be in hardback. Mm. Maybe, I thought.
Which would make a change after 70.
Which would make a change after 70 or so paperbacks, yeah. Yeah, because I was getting ambitious by that time, you see. I'd written these classy BBC serials, and I thought, you know, I could do that hardback stuff, get reviews. You know, it's really interesting. Write 70 books, you don't get any reviews. Now, of course, I had one come out last week and I've still got bugger all reviews, but that's a different that's a different issue. So, yeah.
But then there was another kind of role of feedback or feed forward, if you like, because there was then a TV series made of Resnick, wasn't there? So you've got this sort of TV to
novel to
TV.
A brief foray into television in 92, roughly when the fourth Resnick book was coming out. Two of the programmes were made for television, Lonely Hearts and Rough Treatment.
What was your feeling about them?
In retrospect, I'm not overly fond of them. One of the main problems was I did the scripts, you know, and I'm quite good, I think. Here comes the angel of death, come to collect me. I'm quite good at adapting other people's stuff. I've done a lot of adapting of other people's work for radio. I've done Graham Greene and A.S. Byatt and, you know, the whole...
Not
the whole spectrum, but, you know, a lot of people. And I'm very happy adapting other people's work. I'm very happy taking chunks out and rearranging it and getting it into what I think are the important things. I was crap with my own stuff because I liked bits of it too much. And I would say, oh, I really like that scene. You know, I like that bit of dialogue. We'll keep that. And unfortunately, I had I had a publisher who loved the books as well. And instead of having a publisher, now you see my brain's...
A producer,
that's the word. It begins with P. That's close. I had a producer who loved the books as well. And so instead of the producer saying, look, this doesn't take the narrative on, this isn't helpful, you need to cut that out. You know, he said, oh, yeah, that's nice. I remember that from the book, like that. And it just meant, you know, that we didn't do as well. And then we did this brilliant thing of casting Tom Wilkinson, who was great, and this was before he became, you know, Tom Wilkinson. But then we used him really badly, because we only used him looking serious and pained and distraught and morose. Most of the reviews called him, you know, the joke in the was kind of, you know, here comes the replacement for Morse is morose, was one of the headlines. And, you know, Tom can be really charming as an actor. And, you know, if you think about him in the thing where they all take their kiss off, whatever that's called.
Full Monty.
Thank you. But the director didn't allow him to do that. And it was a real shame because Lonely Hearts has got a really dark story. And it's a and it's also filmed like, you know, current real film noir. You can see people reaching for their television sets and turning up the, you know, trying to turn the brilliance up. And there was Tom at the middle of this, not allowed to be charming or funny or slightly witty or anything. You know, I remember there was one scene, just a tiny little scene, but it gives an indication. He goes into the deli to buy a sandwich, and the woman behind the thing says in the script, you know, says it's ham sandwich. He says she's mustard, yes, Dijon or French or whatever, and Tom says both, and she says Dijon or French, and Tom, you know, kind of did a nice little thoughtful half smile, and, you know, and said both, you know, in a quite sort of, you know, quite nice kind of charming sort of way, and the director leapt on him immediately and said, don't do that, don't be charming, and, you know, so. Yeah, we threw it away, I think, because you can't get away with an hour of, especially in those days, which was kind of pre-Cracker and more or less pre-Prime Suspect. You couldn't get away with several hours of really kind of gritty, grim television without a central character who you at least, you know, liked and identified with and wanted to follow through it. And yeah, so a bit of a bungled effort, I think.
Well, put it down to experience, I guess. Let's talk a bit about the series then. I mean, as far as I understand it, you then wrote the Resnick series uninterrupted for the first 10 novels, is that right?
Yeah.
So yeah. Tell us about, you know, kind of the experience of writing a series. What were the problems? What were the challenges?
Writing a series as such wasn't a problem because I'd been writing series, you know, I mean, that was what I did. So I knew about writing series, I thought. I'd got the hang from doing the television stuff of keeping a number of characters in the air and so on. It became a problem round about book six or seven, really. And I think it was a mixture of me getting lazy and... Oh, no, maybe that was it, really. Maybe it was me getting lazy. You know, I think one of the real problem with writing series, it seems to me, and I'd be interested to know what some of you think about this, is that on the one hand, readers have certain expectations of what they want to find. You know, so you set up early on, hopefully reasonably successfully, all these little kind of quirky things that people expect us have there. So, okay, so I set up Resnick. He's got the cats. God, I hate those cats. He's got the cats. You know, he likes jazz. He makes all these fancy sandwiches. You know, he's always got food all over his tie and so on. So you set all that up, and that's fine. And people read the books, and obviously they like the stories, but I think you go back to series really because you like the character more even than you like the, you know, you're interested in the stories. So people going back to the Resnick books wanted all that stuff. And that's fine, and that's the good thing about writing series. The bad thing about writing series is you've got to give them all that stuff. And I think it encourages you to be lazy. You know? I think, you know, Monday morning, get up, make the first cup of coffee of the day, go to the computer, as it was probably just about by then, probably an Amstrad by that stage. And you think, oh God, what am I going to do today? And you think, oh well, okay. I'll have Resnick get out of bed, go to the shower, weigh himself. He weighs too much on the scales. He goes downstairs. He feeds the cats. He makes coffee. He makes a sandwich. He puts on a jazz record, reads the Nottingham Evening Post, and that's my day's work done. And, you know, I got really lazy, I think, and stopped thinking about... Maybe I didn't think enough about good stories and strong stories, and I just, you know...
But do you think perhaps that a lengthy series actually kind of somehow militates against those things, strong stories and all the rest of it, because the character becomes so fascinating, supposedly?
Well, I don't know. I just think there are problems there, and the problems that some writers avoid and some writers don't, and we could all, without, of course, we won't name them, we could think of writers who have stayed with series for too long. Couldn't we?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I did, I think. All right, yeah, maybe the 10 books was right, but I should have taken a break round about book 6.
But how about the Nottingham location? Did that begin to become...
It became slightly problematic because I moved and I wasn't there anymore. And I think Nottingham worked for me better when I was there and I'd go into the city every day and I'd walk across the town and I would have my cup of coffee in the market where Resnick had his cup of coffee or whatever. And I'd hear the voices and the accents on the buses and stuff. And so it would be a more real place for me. And I think once I'd moved to North London, it became something out there rather than something I was immersed in every day.
So do you think if you'd stayed in Nottingham, the Nottingham locations would still have been a kind of a continuing inspiration?
Probably, but I think 10 books was certainly enough, and maybe I could have eased off. And the other thing is, come on, look, when I said to my publisher at the time, I'm thinking about stopping after 10, they were not, biting my hand off to write any more. So, it wasn't as though there was a commercial imperative. They were doing okay, mm-hmm. but they weren't making anybody a lot of money. They weren't making me a lot of money. They certainly weren't making the publishers a lot of money. So it was generally agreed that, it was time, really.
And just to finish on Resnick, you then have, after writing other things, you've gone back to him, haven't you?
I've gone back to him after 10 years with Cold in Hand. Partly because I did then, my partner and I did then spend 2 years living in Nottingham again, which reinvigorated my interest in the city. But mainly because I found a story then that I thought I could use Resnick for. There were things I wanted to write about. Basically, I wanted to write about the experience of grief. A number of friends, close friends of mine, had died in the time before writing that book, and then, in fact, during writing the book. Including my friend Angus Wells, who I wrote many of those westerns with. And so I wanted to write about that experience, and I thought I could do that best through Resnick, because rather than inventing a totally new fictional character, I thought I could do it through him, because I thought I knew him well enough fictionally to be able to do that. And so that was... And I have to say, my publishers were not overjoyed when I said I was going to write another Resnick novel. Because by then they'd rebranded me, see. I was a name. It's really interesting. If you look at all the Resnick books, the early ones, it's Resnick, John Harvey. At some point in the process, I have to say my bank manager is very happy about this, it became Harvey, and then, the Resnick stuff or whatever is down the bottom. Having successfully rebranded me, when I said I was going to write another Resnick book, they were not happy. And in fact, on the British edition, you'd have to turn to the back of the book to see that it's a Resnick book. Whereas in America, they made much more of a hoopla about it. And in France, they're going to declare another Independence Day or something next year when they publish the next Resnick book. But over here, Random House saw it as a retrograde step,
Right. Well, we've just got 5 minutes left, John, before we go for the audience questions.
Right. Sorry.
Tell us, to make your publishers happy, tell us about Far Cry, your new book.
Yeah, I will. I'll read the first chapter. You'll be blessedly pleased to know that it's a page and a half long. It's not quite as short as Bill's first chapter. When I started thinking about this book, which was in about 2006, I think, it was when all the Madeleine McCann stuff was going on, and there were lots of talk and rumours about the parents, and weren't they behaving in a kind of strange way, and was that normal what they were doing, and were they possibly involved in some way, and so on. And I had I met a novelist friend of mine called Jill Dawson, who lives in Cambridgeshire, who lives in a village in Cambridgeshire near the village of Soham. And a lot of you remember there were two schoolgirls were murdered in Soham few years before, and there was a lot of publicity about that, and especially if you were living close to it. And Jill has two young children, was quite affected by this. And she wrote a novel sort of triggered off by that called Watch Me Disappear, which was published in 2006. And we had this conversation about her book, but also about how parents might respond to a child either dying suddenly from an accident, which is one of the things that happens in Far Cry, or disappearing or being taken or whatever, and the way, you know, the way you might deal with that, you know, was what the McCanns were doing as parents strange? What did we expect them to do? Did we want them breaking down? Did we want them, you know? How did it affect people's relationships when that happens and so on? And so that was the beginning of Far Cry. I thought I wanted to write about those sort of experiences, about parents' feelings about children. And so that was the beginning of the idea. And so this is chapter one. The central character in Far Cry is a woman called Ruth, whose child is involved in an accident on holiday, a fatal accident on holiday. And this, the beginning of the book, is some 10 years later. Ruth sets down her cup, crosses the room and opens the drawer. The kitchen floor strikes cold even through her slippered feet. February. At 7 this morning, when she first stepped outside, it had still been dark. The envelope is where she left it, buried beneath receipts for old electricity bills, scribbled notes from the woman who comes Tuesdays and Thursdays to clean, recipes from this or that magazine. An off-white envelope, self-sealing, buckling a little at the corners. Inside is an ordinary postcard showing a map of southwest Cornwall, coloured largely green. On the reverse side, her name, hers and her ex-husband's, Simon's, are written above the address in a careful, painstaking hand. Mr. and Mrs. Pierce, the old address in London, Northwest 5. The message alongside slanting slightly, left to right. Dear Mum and Dad, went to the beach again today. Big waves. Kelly and I are going to surf school tomorrow. Hope you're both okay. See you soon. Lots of love. Heather. Lots of kisses. Even though she knows it by heart, Ruth reads the words slowly, carefully, taking her time. See you soon. For a moment she closes her eyes. Here and there the map is decorated with illustrations. Truro Cathedral, a cow standing over a pail of milk destined to be Cornish cream. St. Michael's Mount, the rocks at Land's End. Midway between Cape Cornwall and Sennan Cove, close to a zigzag of coast, a small dot has been made with a ballpoint pen. And when Ruth holds it up, as she does now, towards the kitchen window, the afternoon already beginning to fade, she can see a faint pinprick of light through the hole the pen has deliberately made. This is where I am, written in small letters that curve out across the ocean. This is where I am. An arrow pointing to the spot. It's not certain how long she stands there, staring out, staring down, the card in her hand. Then, with a small catch of her breath, she slips the card back into the envelope back into the drawer, and glancing at the clock, turns quickly away. Time to change her shoes, pull on her coat, collect her daughter from school, her other daughter, Beatrice. The one who is still alive.
Thank you, John. Brilliant timing, because it's 2:15, and we'd like to invite questions from the floor now, please. Sir.
Yes, I mean, you're right, there aren't a lot, and a lot of what there are perforce are reduced to, you know, kind of small, you know, kind of paragraph, small paragraphs and so on. Yes, I mean, you're right, there are never a lot. You just always wish there'd be rather more and that they'd happen kind of rather more quickly than they do.
Well, certainly, if they did it by sales, then there should be many more crime fiction reviews than there are. What does everyone else think about that? Should there be more crime fiction reviews? And, well, I guess everyone would say yes, wouldn't we? Yeah. And longer ones, you know, standalones. 800-word reviews. Well, you must have had a few of those, John, recently.
A few, yeah, a few. And that's the trouble, you see. Once you get, you know, once somebody does 800 words in the TLS or the Independent or something, that's what you expect all the time. You know, so when you get, when you go back to getting, you know, the kind of little nutshell paragraphs, you think, oh, is that all? You know, you get spoiled. But it is
still
nice.
It still gives you the quote, though, doesn't it?
It is, yeah, that's true. It is nice to get the odd long review, and it's... It's nice. What tends to happen, I think, is that what other writers' experience is. I mean, I get longer, more detailed reviews in the States and in France than I do in England. And but I think that's probably a general thing. I don't think that's anything to do with me. I think that you know, reviewers just get more space given to them. I mean, certainly in France, they take crime more seriously. I mean, crime writing rather than crime. More serious than they do here, I think.
The LA Times has cut down, Los Angeles Times has cut down their book sections. New York Times has 2 or 3 out of 4 Sundays. Marilyn Stasio has a full page of reviews, each one about 150 words. And the San Francisco Chronicle has a section probably twice a month by Eddie Moore, where he does reviews. Baltimore Sun does reviews also, but they are getting less and less. Many of us depend on reviews on the magazines but they come later. A lot of stuff online right now, yeah. A lot of websites where you can get very, very good reviews. And on the common website in the States, which is Dark VL, there are reviews almost daily by people who are taking it very seriously. And they're not critical reviewers in the sense that they have credentials, but they are reader reviewers, and they're writing down what they like about the books. So that's taken over, I think, the role of a lot of the newspapers.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, and in fact, I mean, you see now on a lot of crime novels that there are starting to be quotations from, you know, the more respected online reviews. So I mean, I'm sure that's the way it's going to go. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You sort of talked about the way you're influenced by sort of American culture, sort of early on, in terms of.
No. It's easy to say why I was enamored at the time, probably. I mean, growing up in Britain in the 50s, from that vantage point, it did seem to be that anything that was exciting was American in terms of popular culture. You know, I mean, jazz and rock and roll and John Steinbeck and Raymond Chandler and movies and stuff, you know, that was what, you know, I spent huge amounts of my adolescence and kind of early 20s and whatever, you know, reveling in. And I suppose two things have happened in the last, I don't know, 10 years or so. I mean, firstly, is a kind of general disenchantment with kind of American foreign policy and American attitudes, which has affected my attitudes to America generally. I mean, I used to go every year, and I've been once in the last 10 years, and that's partly because my publishers don't pay for me to go over anymore, but it's also because I haven't been urging, you know, I haven't urgently wanted to go. I think the other thing that's happened is, and I think, I don't know whether that's a corollary of that I've become more interested in the kind of English roots of what I do, of writing generally. I mean, I think that interest has always been there and that awareness has always been there. You know, I mean, I went to Nottingham when Alan Sillitoe had just been started writing and Saturday Night and Sunday Morning and so on were very, very current. And I was very aware of that and aware of Lawrence and so on and all of those people who were writing about the provinces at the time. But I think there were English influences in my that come to bear in my work that I maybe wasn't too aware of when it was happening. You know, things like huge amounts of British television, I think, were really important. I now see in what I do in crime writing. I'm thinking about, you know, Zed Cars, the fact that Ken Loach, you know, people like Ken Loach works on Zed Cars and then works on Play for the Day, and that whole thing about, you know, kind of realist, kind of almost documentary television work, I think was really important. And I think, you know, has influenced quite a lot of British crime writing.
Thank you. Maxim.
Now that you've reached your 100th novel, I understand from other sources that you're taking a year off from writing.
What?
I don't regret you for holiday, but how can a writer take a year off?
I've paid the mortgage, Maxim. That's it. I've paid the mortgage.
As a present to yourself?
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's an interesting year for me this year. I've got my 100th book, my 70th birthday, various other bits and pieces. I think one of the things that happens when you reach 70 is you think, well, you know, what do you want to do in the next 10, 12, 14 years? And maybe the answer isn't, I want to write a book a year. You know, I think, and I've written a book, apart from when my youngest daughter was born and I took 18 months, 2 years off. I've written, you know, I wrote 12 books a year for a long time, and then for the last 20 years, I've written a book a year. And it gets more difficult. It gets more difficult to think of things, interesting things to write. You know, and I think I'm doing myself a favour by taking time off, but I think I'm probably doing, you know, potential readers a favour by taking time off. No, seriously, because I think, you know, you need... if there were a book I absolutely urgently wanted to write, if, you know, like I wanted to write Cold in Hand for specific reasons, then I would do it. But there isn't. So I could force myself to write a book, because that's what I do, you know. A lot of the books I've written because I've been contracted to write a book. And that would apply to some of the Resnick books, just as it would apply to, you know, Herne the Hunter 23 or whatever it was. But I'm not in that situation. I don't have to write a book this year. I haven't got a contract to write anything, so I'm probably not going to write anything. You know, if I do, then I do, but I probably won't. And maybe next year, you know, maybe next year I will, but I kind of feel I owe it to myself to have a rest. And I probably owe it to, you know, some of you to have a rest too.
Bill.
How do you bring back to your old audience Charlie Resnick, and how do you introduce him to a new audience? Because we have anticipations. Charlie disappeared for a period of time. We need to know what happened, and new people may not know who he is.
Yeah, I think that part of the truth of that is that the audience that knew who he was relatively small. You know, I mean, they would have sold, the Resnick books would have sold when they first came out 20,000 in paperback in this country, tops. 25,000. Cold in Hand sold 120,000 in paperback. I mean, because of my publishers and not because of anything I've done, really, I've got a different audience now and a much bigger audience now. So getting them to know this Resnick compared to the old Resnick wasn't really much of an issue, because most people buying Cold in Hand wouldn't have read Resnick before. Hopefully they're going back now, and the backlist seems to be doing okay, so presumably they are. As for, you know, loyal readers like yourself, I think he's still recognised to be the same person. I mean, I'd written short stories about him in between. You know, he crops up in some of the Frank Elder books, just in the odd scene, the odd chapter. He's there. You know, he was always there in my mind, especially in the Nottingham scenes. If I did any books in Nottingham, he'd be there. So, you know, he's had a continuing life. And all I think I had to show to people who'd read the earlier 10 books was, you know, just to put in enough information to show what had happened to him in that intervening period. But it was really writing a book for mainly a different audience. So it wasn't a major issue, to be honest.
Time for one more question. Yeah, Elaine.
John, you said earlier that you've been influenced in your early writing by American culture. Are there any American authors that you still read today?
Yes, but not from an... not. Do you mean as an influence, or do you mean for pleasure? Oh, yeah. I mean, yes. I read. I'm not going to think of any now, am I?
That bloke you wrote. Yeah.
That bloke. Yes. Okay. I read George Pelicanos. I'm running out.
Dennis Lane.
I liked Mystic River a lot.
Dennis Lane.
Michael Connelly?
Yes, sorry, thank you. Yes, Michael Connelly, James Lee Burke. I tell you, I'll be honest with you, I've more or less stopped reading crime fiction. That's the truth of it. You know, I've read two crime novels this year out of about 30, 35 books. I read probably five crime novels last year, and one of those was Peter Temple's The Broken Shore twice. I've kind of had it with crime fiction, really, reading it. There are certain people I'll always read. Like, hopefully I would always want to read a George Pelicans book. You know, maybe that's part of my answer to Maxim that I didn't kind of give. I want to break from writing, but also I want to break from, you know, I've done crime fiction for too long, maybe. I don't know.
So what happens next?
Oh, God knows. I'm certainly not going to write a novel.
Quickly.
Thank you.
Well, I think you said that already, haven't you? Okay, I'm going to nail you with a couple of unexpected questions. They only need very short answers.
Okay.
I like to creep up behind my interviewees. The first is, in an ideal world, given any opportunity or whatever, which crime novel would you like to put your name to?
Oh, that's easy. Actually...
Don't go too far.
I can give you several. Can I give you several?
Yeah, okay.
I came prepared.
Oh, God, there goes my unexpected question.
Well, no, well, you know what it's like? You come to these things and people say to you, as you did, you know, who do you like? Who do you read? And, of course, I can never think. Okay, I would like to have written...
He's got a list of about 25 long.
I won't read them all. I would like to have written some or all of these. I won't mention the obvious ones like The Last Good Kiss because I'm sure anybody would like to have written. Mm. I would like to have written The Man Who Likes Slow Tomatoes by Casey Constantine, who's an incredibly underrated writer. I would like to have written The Edge of the Crazies by Jamie Harrison, who's Jim Harrison's daughter. I would like to have written Roses, Roses by Bill James. I would like to have written Looking for Chet Baker by Bill Moody. I would like to have written Drive by James Salis. I would like to have written The Broken Shore by Peter Temple and Give Us a Kiss by Daniel Woodrell. Will that do?
That'll do for that question.
That's the ballpark. Yeah, they're all great books, aren't they? I mean, just...
Well, they're all of a piece as well, aren't they?
Are they?
Sort of. Anyway, let's leave that. We can argue about that afterwards. Okay. The last question was similar but more expanded. Which book... of any kind would you like to put your name to? One this time, and no looking at lists.
The Fall of the Roman Empire.
Well, it's going to be two, The Rainbow and Women in Love.
All right. Interesting, yeah.
Lawrence Nottingham.
Yep, Lawrence, good man. Okay, before I wind up, I just have to remind you of a couple of things. You've no doubt heard this so often that you're getting bored with it. But I have to tell you that Criminal Tendencies Anthology Party will take place at 5:30 in the Club Lounge, wherever that is, I suppose someone knows. And also, you should buy raffle tickets because you will potentially win an MP3 player with lots of crime fiction downloaded onto it. And also, potentially, a Bristol Blue Glass decanter into which you can pour whatever claret or whatever you like. And those will benefit the RNIB. Ladies and gentlemen, please thank very warmly John Harvey.
Thank you.